Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Columbus Mayor Andrew Ginther and the local Fraternal Order of Police remain divided on the issue of policing reforms following a closed-door meeting Thursday. Earlier last week, the mayor urged the police union to get on board with changes in how the Division of Police operates, starting with the formation of a civilian review board.
So let me be very clear to the FOP. You're either with us or you're against the community. I urge you to join us, or the community will hold you accountable.
Coming up, we'll have our usual weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us now is Columbus Dispatch reporter Bethany Bruner, who has been covering the push for police reform at City Hall. Welcome back, Bethany.
Thanks for having me back, Ann.
You heard the mayor say to the FOP, you're either with us or against the community. He really threw down the gauntlet there, did he not? But what? Anything?
Well, it's to be determined. He definitely threw down the proverbial gauntlet during that press briefing last week, and he held a closed-door meeting with the Fraternal Order of Police president later in the week. Both the mayor and the Fraternal Order of Police issued comments after that indicated that they're really not anywhere close to being on the same page right now in terms of how they're understanding each other and where they'd like to go and how quickly they'd like to get there.
Has the mayor illuminated what happens if the Fraternal Order of Police is not on board, if they're not with them?
He really hasn't yet. I think they're hoping that this will kind of spur discussions and move things forward, but you know, we haven't heard explicitly what they're hoping will happen and what they plan to do if the FOP doesn't come to the place that they want them to be.
So what do you think the strategy is then?
I think a lot of it is public pressure and public perception. From what I'm hearing on both sides of this is, you know, they're trying to kind of wage this war in the media. They're trying to really kind of get people on their side and see what's going on the other side of things, you know, to kind of turn people to one side or the other and say, well, this person or this side is doing what I want them to do and this side isn't. So, you know, what's happening behind closed doors, we don't really know.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely been a public war of words going on.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Coming up, our weekly reporter roundtable. Right now, I'm talking with Bethany Bruner of the Columbus Dispatch about what looks like something of a standoff between the mayor and the Fraternal Order of Police when it comes to police reforms. Any kind of issue that the FOP has said they won't budge on specifically?
They haven't said that they're unwilling to negotiate anything at this point. What they want to do and what they want to see is some sort of concrete plan as to what, you know, what a civilian review board will look like. We know from our reporting and from reporting that other outlets have done that civilian review boards take a multitude of appearances across the country in terms of what they're able to investigate, who's on those boards, how long they're seated for. And what we have been told by the FOP is that they would really like to see a plan before they make any sort of commitment to agreeing to it. They want to make sure that it's something that they should be agreeing to versus, you know, agreeing to this and then all of a sudden they're in a position they don't want to be in. But they haven't explicitly said no to anything.
Well, you know, that makes sense that they want to see a plan, but I got the idea that the mayor wants them to be in on the planning.
Well, that's, I think, one of the biggest controversies in all of this. The FOP says we want to be in on the planning, and they're saying the mayor isn't allowing them a seat at the table or isn't committing to having a seat at the table for them. The mayor's office says we want them at the table. They're not willing to come. So, you know, somewhere in the middle of that is probably the reality. But as of right now, you know, all we're hearing is from the different sides that there's some sort of disagreement going on about who's going to be at the table and when.
And the idea of dropping the qualified immunity is a non-starter, according to the FOP, the Ohio Fraternal Order of Police. Explain what qualified immunity is and why it is troublesome to officers, representatives?
Well, qualified immunity is a legal concept that essentially gives officers a wide breadth of discretion in exercising their authority. It basically allows them to be immune or exempt from facing civil legal action, in particular, for actions they take while on duty. So if they, you know, a very benign example, but, you know, if they tow somebody's car illegally and that person then sues them, you know, well, if they were doing it in the course of their duties and they had a legitimate probable cause to do it, there might not be any sort of civil penalty. That obviously escalates when you're talking about an officer-involved shooting or the taking of someone's life. Many lawsuits, civil lawsuits that are filed against officers end up being dismissed because of that qualified immunity. And, you know, advocates who want that immunity taken away or narrowed say that, it gives them more recourse to hold officers accountable for their actions, while officers' representatives, you know, the state FOP, the national FOP, have concerns that that opens both police officers, police agencies, and even municipalities to a certain extent to additional legal penalties, monetary penalties that they may not be willing to pay out.
Is there any sense that the drop in qualified immunity would only apply to serious cases of injury or death?
There's no implication of that at this point. What I have been seeing and hearing is that it would be a blanket drop. It wouldn't be specific to certain types of cases or certain types of situations. So it would really be kind of an all or nothing type of scenario.
And why do they say it's such a sticking point? Is it just the nickel and diming the police department or the individuals to death? I mean, then you'd be responsible for any number of things if it's blanket. Or what?
I think there's just a general sense of accountability and where do we draw the line in allowing officers to do their job and litigating issues to the point of, you know, we're tying cases up in federal court for years and years or in civil court for years and years. Many of these cases do end up being filed in U.S. District Court because of civil rights issues. So I think there's just a concern about whether or not this hinders officers' ability to do their job. That's what we hear from the FOP a lot, from advocates for police, not just the FOP, but advocates for police a lot, is that if you take away some of these things, officers will hesitate to do their job the way they've been trained to do, and that potentially causes other issues.
The Speaker of the Ohio House of Representatives, Larry Householder, has threatened to, I don't know how he would yet, but remove from the oversight of the city the Capitol Square, which would include, I guess, Rhodes Tower, Rife Tower, the State House, of course, the parking lots and so forth. Have you gotten any, have you heard any feedback from the city over this exclamation?
We haven't really heard a whole lot of feedback. I think, like what you just kind of alluded to, that there's a lot of logistical issues regarding that, how that would go about being done. I think this is just kind of, we're just going to, you know, take a back seat on commenting on this one and kind of let things kind of play out as they're going to play out, at least at this point. There's obviously been some back and forth between state officials and local officials in terms of who's going to pay for damage that was done and the cleanup costs around particularly the State House. And that is a conversation that is ongoing, to my understanding.
Also, speaking of towing a car, you use that as an example of how the qualified immunity could affect an officer if they had someone's car towed and it turned out that it was done improperly. At demonstrations this weekend downtown, police were having cars towed if they were parked too far from the curb. I saw videos of them actually getting out tape measures and measuring how far the cars were from the curb. What's going on down there now? I mean, is there any sense about how they're getting along?
Well, I saw those same videos and those same photos, Anne, and, you know, we really don't know what is going on. I know, generally speaking, police are, you know, when they're called to tow a car, it's typically because it's been somewhere for a long period of time and mm-hmm. that neighborhood would like that spot of curb back. I don't know what was going on with this particular instance, if they received a complaint about it or if they were just merely trying to get cars off of that street. I know many of the parking meters in that stretch of road were bagged. They were
this is along Broad Street in front of the
along Broad Street, High Street, and Front Street.
Okay,
kind of that area between the State House and City Hall, where a bulk of the protests over the weekend were centered. At least for the majority of the time, they were centered in that area, and they had bagged many of those meters so that they weren't parking was not permitted in those areas. But not every meter was bagged, and I believe the car that we've seen the most photos and videos surrounding it being towed was parked at a meter that was able to be parked at.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know the full circumstances surrounding that. That's something we're looking into to try and get some more information mm-hmm. as to what was happening there. And hopefully we'll know more soon.
Any sense about how police are getting along with demonstrators as these demonstrations continue and are expected to continue?
Yeah, for the most part, it seems like police are avoiding the area during the day. Where we have seen the most tension and the most ramp up has been kind of in that between 7 and 10 o'clock at night. And it seems like anytime police show up, whether they're driving by or whether they're there, it draws a definite response from the group that is out there demonstrating and protesting. So there is a lot of tension still. It's definitely not a situation where everybody is on the same page. There's definitely still a lot of tension.
Well, Beth Bruner, thanks so much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me, Ann. I'm glad to be here.
Bethany Bruner is a crime and police reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Coming up, we're going to hear from our regular State House reporters, so stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us by Skype, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Andy.
Hi, Ann.
Also, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Jeremy.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press. Welcome, Julie.
Happy to be here.
Julie, House Speaker Larry Householder, in an interview with the Ohio Christian Alliance last week, talked about splitting Capitol Square away from Columbus after the State House was damaged during demonstrations. What do you make of that? Is there any precedent?
Well, I mean, obviously, Washington, D.C. is its own district, and he made mention of the fact that it could be something similar to that, a political district within the city. But I do think that the unprecedented way that these protests have happened and the vandalism is probably pretty unique. I mean, he's seizing an opportunity, but clearly it's historic and may never happen again. So whether there is political will to do something like that is unclear. To me, it feels as if it's a way to try to make this partisan and make it about how Republicans are the party of law and order and Democrats who are in charge of the city of Columbus are somehow siding with the protesters, which is not really the case.
Right. Jeremy Pelzer, has the speaker described how he would go about this?
Well, I don't think this is a really serious proposal. It's just a way for him to get attention to the fact that there are a lot of lawmakers, especially Republican lawmakers, who are really unhappy with I guess both the protests and what the police response or lack of response has been, as well as the damage done to the State House, the windows broken. I heard some of the paint that was used in demonstrations isn't easily coming off, and so this is just a reflection of discontent with that. I mean, I would be very shocked if Speaker Householder lays out a specific plan for how to do this. I think he's going to kind of stop it right here.
So he's just, you know, doing a feigning couch routine then, Andy Chow?
Well, I mean, I guess it remains to be seen. The speaker made these comments on a conservative podcast, and I don't know if he's been available for additional comment on it. So I guess, I mean, if he continues to sort of push out that narrative, then things might change. But I think one of the biggest questions is what kind of support does he have for a move like that? The Senate President Larry Obhoff said that he doesn't think that it's possible and not really the time to be talking about something like that. But again, pushing it more towards what he called the underlying issue of vandalism at the State House. And, you know, honestly, Ann, I've been trying to kind of look up what kind of procedure does need to happen for something like that to even take place. And I'm not even sure what would need to happen. So if it's something that the speaker really wants to pursue, then it'll be interesting to see what kind of policymaking strategy needs to happen.
The speakers threatened to pay for repairs with money that the state normally sends to the city of Columbus through the local government fund. Julie Carr-Smyth, could they pull something like that off without, you know, doing a contortionist act?
Well, I think it would be difficult. I mean, the best that they could do might be to earmark those funds, but they would have to have a capital bill, I think, to re-earmark something like that. Mm-hmm. Also, recalling that the State House is run by its own advisory board, the Capitol Square Review and Advisory mm-hmm. Board, and Householder does chair that at the moment, I think. But you know, it does operate in its own bubble in a way. And they can do certain things, but not without legislation. And so without the Senate and House both on board, I think, as I think Jeremy says, it's more grandstanding than anything.
Has the governor?
The interesting thing was that we did see some protests during the shutdown protests. We did see some people trying to open windows, and we definitely saw people coming after people to try to keep them from damaging the State House.
And a window was broken. Just one window was broken during that time, too.
Mm-hmm. So it's not just the Black Lives Matter protests. It's the other shutdown protests as well have been a problem.
Right.
Yeah. What about the governor? Has he weighed in on any of this, you guys?
Yeah. So, you know, when the handprints were left on the State House, that's when the speaker tweeted out a message of really calling for action and saying that he's been disappointed with the state's response in protecting the State House. The governor responded by saying that this is something that needs to be taken seriously. The vandalism and the breaking of things needs to be taken seriously. And then he addressed specifically the leaving the painted handprints issue. And he said that troopers were aware that it was happening, but did not have enough staff to properly handle the situation. And the governor said that that's not something that's going to happen in the future. And just speaking anecdotally, as someone who works at the State House mm-hmm. regularly, there was a definite, you could clearly see a scaled down amount of troopers. You know, during the height of the protests, you saw many more troopers at the State House. And then in the weeks following, I think you could see a decrease in the number of troopers who were at the State House. That has been ramped up again, by witnessing it firsthand, seeing more troopers around the State House.
I mean, do we know if there's a strategy with the Highway Patrol? I guess they're the ones, right?
Yeah, and they've been stationed out of a specific room in the State House, and they've had all their gear there, and they have deployed people wearing hard gear at times, people wearing soft gear when there are bigger numbers of demonstrators at in the downtown area. At the height of it, you'll see many troopers lined up around the windows, lined up around the border of the State House, 7, 8, 10 troopers just lined up shoulder to shoulder. And then, you know, that decreased after a while, and now you're starting to see those numbers ramp up again.
Yeah, and what's interesting is that Householder has said something to the effect of, well, the state doesn't have police, it's the cities who have police, yeah. And that was odd because obviously the state patrol are right. State police. So I felt like, again, he's trying to draw some kind of a wedge between the Republican and Democratic messaging here.
Well, and then also his emphasis on punishment and who doles out the punishment. I think he thinks that City Attorney Zach Klein is being too easy on him. I don't know whether Ron O'Brien, the Franklin County prosecutor, plays a role in any of this, but he was suggesting that the adjudication of all of this would go through the state attorney general's office, which, again, it seems kind of.
Yeah. I mean, he's hitting on really the incredible jurisdictional issues that happen in a capital city.
Yeah.
I mean, we have county government. We're the seat of state government, county government, and city government. And so, you know, some basic communication breakdowns can weigh into these kind of conflicts. And it may not have anything to do with somebody not really wanting to enforce the law properly or keep the State House from getting damaged.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It is our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Julie Carr-Smythe, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Also with us by Skype, Andy Chow, reporter with the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. And by phone, Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. 6 weeks into the state's reopening, and COVID-19 cases are on the rise in Ohio, surpassing 50,000 as of yesterday afternoon. Andy Chow, where are we on all of this? We don't have a state health director. I mean, I guess we do have an interim, but he's a lawyer. Where are we?
Well, the number of cases are definitely trending upwards. For the one of the stats that the state likes to look at, and by state, I should say, Governor Mike DeWine has been pushing this stat out a lot, is the 21-day trend. He says that you can't really read the numbers one day at a time. It gives you a better outlook if you look at the trend. So the 21-day average increase in cases was around, you know, 400 to 500 increased cases a day. Over the past couple of days, we've seen an increase of 800 or 900 new cases a day. So that's up fairly high compared to the 21-day average. I think the biggest argument here would be made that that the state's definitely seeing a much higher amount of testing happening around the state, where I believe like one of the days recently, the state tested 19,000 people in a day. But what you have to look at and what health experts say you have to look out is the positivity rate. So what percentage of those people who are being tested are testing positive? That number, that positivity rate number, has been floating around the 5%, 6%. But health experts and Governor DeWine say that this is a worrisome stat, seeing all these increases in cases.
Particularly there are folk in certain places.
There have been hot spots,
yeah.
Right? There's a hot spot in Hamilton County. Mm-hmm. Also, we saw a really strong lowering of the average age. Mm-hmm. And some of that can't be explained away by the increased testing, DeWine said. So, you know, there are a lot of factors there, including, obviously, I mean, the weather got nicer.
Mm-hmm.
Schools have gotten out or whatever you want to say about school and how you describe what has happened. But, you know, people are going out playing sports, maybe trying to be with their friends again. You know, colleges have.
Well, I mean, all you have to do is drive down High Street into the Short North and you see that it's primarily younger people.
Right, and so many of them have gotten the message earlier that they were less susceptible, mm-hmm. and so there's a chance. I mean, the science is still in the works here, but there's a chance that they are being less careful. We had one of our youngest deaths, I think, last week. So
it was a 20-something, but it was pre-existing conditions.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Seriously, pre-existing conditions. And the governor has announced, Jeremy Pelzer, that there's a nationwide search to replace Amy Acton as state health director. A nationwide search. I mean, that means what that says to me is this is going to take a long time.
And it means that no one in Ohio is really wanting this job right now. I mean, if you remember when Amy Acton was hired last year, she was the last member of DeWine's cabinet hired. So he had a crazy time trying to fill the position in the first place. And even now, I can't imagine anyone who would really want this job right now. I don't think they're in any real hurry to fill it. Lance Hines, who's the interim director, he has been interim director, three times before? So I don't think that they're in any rush to fill it, but it'd be interesting to see who they come up with.
Well, he's a lawyer, and he's been three times before, but never during a pandemic. There was a report in the Columbus Dispatch today about who had how much say in the deliberations over reopening the state, Andy Chow. What about that? I mean, any revelations for you?
Well, that was an interesting report, because what it really kind of shined a light on was something that we've known about, which is the numbers and the amount of people on each advisory board. So just to recap for people, before the governor made announcements for which sectors were to open, he created advisory panels for different sectors. So he had a restaurant advisory panel, a salons and barbershop advisory panel, and most of the members on that panel were professionals in that area. So you had barbers and you had restaurant owners. And then if you had a 16-member panel, you might have had two or three or four people on the panel who represented being health experts. And so I think it still remains to be seen how much of a voice those health experts had. I think the article was making the argument that because there were lower numbers of people on the panel, maybe they weren't listened to as much. But that has been the argument for the past couple of weeks now, is that when the state came up with its plan to reopen businesses, was it siding more with the economy or siding more with health? And the argument from Governor DeWine has said that these two things have to go hand in hand, that the state needed to get the economy going and still protect people's health, and that they thought that they could carry out a plan that accomplished both.
A big issue has been whether or not people wear face coverings. It's clear now, we know, the science is telling us that face coverings are the most important way to protect ourselves from each other. Just like you aren't allowed to go barefoot into a restaurant because it's unsafe. But people don't seem to be responding to the need for face masks. And the governor made a choice early on, right away, Julie Carr Smyth, to not mandate face coverings.
Right. In fact, he mandated them one day
right.
and relaxed on it the next. And you can see in that swift turnaround exactly how political this is been made. When you're right, I mean, it should be the type of health regulation that's like any other health regulation.
No shirt, no shoes, no service. Yeah.
Right. And actually, they even came up with that, something like no shirt, no shoes, no mask, or something like that. And it just, the groups that are feeling, that are sort of keep the government out of my business type voters are really against this. They're calling it a constitutional violation and on their liberty, and Republicans particularly are having to walk a careful line there. The governor has tried to simply evoke the golden rule and say, you know, it's just that you're not doing it for you, you're doing it for other people. But we're seeing a lot more people and settings where not everyone is wearing them.
Any sense that the governor might change that tack if we start to see more spikes, Jeremy Pelzer, as he said?
Well,
Well, one thing interesting that the governor said last week is that he's looking at more of a local approach. So different areas of the state.
Oh, now they're going to let the locals take control. Okay.
And that's really interesting. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm chuckling too, because if you remember a few weeks ago or a couple of months ago, the governor said that would be a disaster.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he said that would be a real problem. So now he hasn't really said why there's a change in approach, but, you know, he's looking at a more local response to such things.
Huh. Well, and it's interesting, Ann, because we have this constant push-pull in Ohio about local, you know, and the fact that the state house Republicans often are pushing back against, say, Democratic cities that are trying to impose any number of rules that the Republicans oppose, such mm-hmm. as, you know, everything from gun bans and plastic bags and et cetera. So, I mean, if the governor suddenly said that, and then we saw the big cities that are having a bad time impose masks, would the Republican legislature come back and reverse that?
Mm-hmm. Right. I'm passing another law banning local ordinances regarding face masks.
Right. And, you know, it's just interesting how this has caught on. And some of it comes straight down from the president, in the sense that he and Mike Pence are not wearing masks and are setting that example and tone nationally. And so it's difficult for a governor like Mike DeWine to get his message across when the inconsistency there from government leaders is confusing to people.
You know, Andy Chow, has he lost anything in terms of how he's coming across by losing Amy Acton?
That's a good question, Ann. You know, a recent Quinnipiac poll showed that DeWine still has a lot of support among Ohioans, but I think that, you know, if you were to do another poll, sans Amy Acton, maybe the results would be a little different. I think another problem, just communications-wise or mm-hmm. marketing-wise, is that this has been a very long period of time. So something that might have been an effective message in March and April is wearing down. And you mentioned driving up and down High Street. I think that there's a certain amount of just fatigue that's coming with this pandemic, where people are saying, you know, even if I know the risks, I'm going to go out and do my own thing. And I think it's become a challenge for state officials, including Governor DeWine, to continue to keep that message going, that this is a marathon, not a sprint. And I know just firsthand, as a journalist wanting to get more answers on the health side of things, mm-hmm. You know, if the things that come up at these briefings, when you don't have a medical expert like
right.
Dr. Amy Acton standing there to answer questions, that makes it difficult too.
Yeah.
He's having guest medical experts come in at times, mm-hmm. but usually they're tasked with sort of answering a particular or addressing a particular issue on that day. They're not really there for the Q&A so much.
Well, even you guys, I mean, the Q&A is what it is, but there's no time for follow-ups. Mm-hmm. Not everybody gets to ask a question. I don't get to see you. I only see the governor and the lieutenant governor, whoever else they have with them. Is there any struggle internally with the Ohio Legislative Correspondents Association on how this is all playing out? Jeremy?
The Correspondents Association, they only handle the legislature. This is an executive branch.
Yeah.
So the Correspondents Association doesn't really have power.
Okay.
Really, what we can do is, if we have a problem, we can just ask the governor's office to do something about it, and then kind of leave it to them.
It just seems like they're front-loading these things now so heavily that there's very little time left for questions from reporters, Andy Chow.
Yeah, and I think the biggest frustration for me has been what you just said, the follow-up, where usually you can ask a question, you get the answer, and then you really want to drill down into something, and you can't really get that back and forth. And it's not necessarily anyone's fault. It's just kind of the nature of the situation, where we're doing it remotely. So the governor's in a different room miles away from where we're standing, and there's just kind of not that sort of repartee that you usually have.
Also, he's they're only carving out maybe 20 or 30 minutes for these questions.
Right, and the Correspondents Association did get consulted in terms of we went from a mad dash to the
right, which was stupid. Yeah, right.
To a lottery, but you're right. I mean, they're getting shorter and they're getting less frequent, and that may have to change as the virus spikes again. I mean, we're seeing these same spikes all over the country, and we're even watching some states crack back down and some countries crack back down on things by saying, you know, we didn't get it. And there's some new attention around the fact that the asymptomatic people are actually spreading it more than we knew, or that was really accepted for a long time.
And I do want to add, Anne, even with the issues and the challenges that come with that press briefing, I think it is worth mentioning that, you know, the governor's administration has been very receptive, or they've been easy to get a hold of to answer certain follow-up questions when it comes to trying to get data and everything like that. But again, with such a difficult situation and things that are ever changing, it is nicer to sort of have a briefing to go back and forth on instead.
We will return with our weekly reporter roundtable. That's Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also with us, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press and Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us by Skype, Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio Statehouse News Bureau. Also, Jeremy Pelzer of Cleveland.com and Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press are with us. Let's talk about jobless claims. They continue to fall, but there was a little uptick in new claims for the week of June 14th to the 20th. Jeremy Pelzer, what do we know about the jobless claims and how the state's managing the demand?
Well, as you said, last week, or I guess the week before, the number of continued claims continues falling. So the number of people who previously filed and now are going to their next weeks of getting benefits, those numbers declined. But as you said, the numbers ticked up by a couple of thousand. And, you know, that I guess as, you know, it's not the first time that they've ticked back up. But we need to pay attention to see if this is a trend or just sort of a blip.
I think the payroll protection program is about to expire that helped people out from the Congress. And so, you know, that'll be interesting to watch this week just to see, you know, what happens with federal help on that front.
A coalition of school administrators and teachers from Ohio's largest city school districts are calling on the governor and the State Department of Education to make some decisions regarding funding to operations. Andy Chow, what do we know about that?
So that coalition known as the Ohio 8, representing Ohio's 8 urban districts, said that the state is about to come into $330 million for schools that are supposed to be devoted to schools through the Congressional CARES Act. The argument is that they believe that this non-binding guideline coming down from the U.S. Department of Education and Betsy DeVos would steer $10 million of those dollars to private schools. So the argument here from the traditional public schools are saying that they want to be able to keep that money to be able to perform all the new operations that they're going to be needing to do for the new school year. a lot of what they talked about was, you know, what are these guidelines? What are the requirements going to look like for schools in the new school year? Will students be mandated to wear masks? Will desks have to be 6 feet away from each other? And what do you do with busing? So there's all sorts of concerns and a high price tag that comes with those concerns.
And you refer to it as non-binding, that $330 million. I thought that she'd switched it from guidance to an order.
And that's the argument that's being made, is that the administrators believe that if you were to look at the legality of it, that it would, that the state could consider it non-binding. So it's the argument of, you know, should DeWine be following what the U.S. Department of Education is going through, or is there sort of a hitch to it that they could find?
Has he responded to that question, how he feels about what's been taking place regarding this?
You know, I haven't heard him say anything about it. Going back to the issue of these briefings, is you get one question. This was one of the questions on my list, but I had a couple of others mm-hmm. ahead of it. So unless Jeremy or Julie have heard anything, I haven't heard him address this.
I haven't, no. And what was interesting last week is what I noted was that the fact that the virus average age went down significantly last week was the news on the exact same day. We all kind of expected him to make some more announcements on what's happening with school.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that they may be sort of regrouping around this mm-hmm. new idea mm-hmm. that the virus is affecting younger people and becoming more of a danger there.
And is it absolute that the schools are reopening in the fall, Jeremy Pelzer? Has that been clarified?
Well, it's up to every school district. And right now it appears like they probably will be, but there's no final decision has been made. And the state really has delegated that to the local districts. Hmm. So it'll be up to each 600 or so districts. They'll each have their own plan in place about what to do.
Hmm. Yeah.
And I know, Anne, that some districts are thinking about breaking the classrooms in half and having half of them come in physically half the time mm-hmm. and doing it digitally another half the time. So, you know, to keep the social distancing and all that. But, I mean, it could be a potentially expensive endeavor to try to work all this out.
And something that I learned last week, so I was able to talk to a bunch of different school administrators from around the state, including the Reynoldsburg City School District. And what they were saying is basically because they're waiting for the state to come down with guidelines, that these different school districts have created various options. So they have something for scenario A, B, C, and D, and then they're just waiting for the state to come down with their guidelines in order to sort of hit the dominoes and see where they fall after that.
Is there any sense of those people that you talk to, Andy, that some districts are going to have tougher times than others?
Yeah, it seems like one of the biggest themes that I heard is that schools that have to bus more students are going to face maybe a bigger challenge. So if there is a guideline or a requirement when it comes to busing, and if you have to cut the ridership in half, then how are you going to bus all those students from one school, from one place to another? And that kind of gets into what I think Julie just mentioned is, you know, do you have to stagger classes and have a group of students come in on Monday and Wednesday, and then another group of students come in Tuesday and Thursday? And so those are different scenarios that districts are trying to figure out.
Let's talk politics. a poll, well, there's lots of polling coming out now, as you guys are fully aware of, and one shows a statistical tie between the Republican President Donald Trump and the presumptive Democratic nominee Joe Biden in Ohio. Julie Carr Smythe, where are we with all of that these days? How is the president faring in Ohio?
Well, you're right. The polling most recently is showing them pretty well in a statistical tie. And, of course, that's significant because Donald Trump won Ohio by such a strong majority. I mean, he had an 8%, I think, win here, which is huge for mm-hmm. such a divided state.
Right.
So, and he seems to be losing among some white voters, among suburban voters, women, and a lot of it has to do with the COVID response, the response to the racial uprisings, and basically there's a lot of anxiety out there and pushback around just sort of wanting something different, and that's moving in the direction of Joe Biden right now. I just think it's kind of too soon to tell, because Trump will clearly have a very strong and well-funded push heading into the fall, mm-hmm. and to make his points. And Biden more or less is sort of just letting things, sort of letting Trump, you know, make his own mistakes and and just live with that and not making too much of a fuss. People, voters know him quite well, and mm-hmm. I think he feels the senses that he doesn't need to do that much campaigning.
Well, and of course, the whole virus issue impact on campaigning has affected, I think, Biden's calculus somewhat, but not the the president's going forward. Jeremy Pelzer, he doesn't seem to be worried about that now.
No, it's steady as she goes for the president, and you know, it's. I think Julie's absolutely right that Joe Biden's trying to make this election a referendum on President Trump,
which is typical.
And the best, which is typical, and so the best way to do that is, you know, shut up and let the president do his own thing. And so that's why every time you see a Trump campaign person say, you know, where's Joe Biden? Why isn't Joe Biden coming out and campaigning? They're trying to draw him out so Joe Biden can make, you know, he's kind of gaffe prone in the past, so they're waiting for him to come out and hopefully make another gaffe. But at least that's what they're hoping.
Prominent Republicans in Ohio, Andy Chow, of which there are many because the entire state government's run by Republicans, and one of our two state senator or two U.S. senators is Republican, obviously. Where are they coming down on the Trump litmus test?
Well, it seems like most of them have been pretty quiet. I mean, your usual people who are further to the right, conservatives, have been more vocal on things. But, you know, as per usual, somebody like Senator Rob Portman is quieter on the issue of Donald Trump and not really quick to jump to respond to one thing or the other that the president does. I think something that's interesting with these polls, and again, you never know how accurate a poll might be,
yes.
but the people who look at polls, they decide where resources go. So maybe if you're seeing a statistical tie in Ohio, a state that maybe the president thought that he had more locked up, maybe they have to devote more resources here, more funding here, maybe make more trips here that maybe he wasn't planning on doing previously.
So as much money as he does have in his campaign war chest, Julie Carr-Smyth, he may have to spend it all to pull this one off.
Right, yeah, and we are seeing divisions. Rob Portman did say last week that he's not sure he's going to go to the Republican National Convention.
In Jacksonville, right.
Mm-hmm. Right, and we saw the weird attendance stuff around Trump's rally. And so I think any idea of, like, the traditional Republican just sort of throwing caution to the wind around the virus isn't necessarily happening. And DeWine has said he supports the president, but then we've seen our former governor, John Kasich, and some of his allies mm-hmm. working more toward a Biden victory.
Yeah, we talked about former state GOP chair Matt Borges mm-hmm. participating in and helping found a PAC. To
right.
oppose Trump.
Well, and there was a Republican Party down in Warren County last week that reprimanded or rebuked DeWine for his virus response. You know, they wanted the economy open sooner. They wanted more autonomy. And, you know, so these issues are dividing Republicans here. And, you know, maybe that's good for the Democrats.
We will have a lot more to talk about in coming reporter roundtables. But for now, I have to say goodbye. Julie Carr-Smyth of the Associated Press, thanks for your time as always.
Thanks for having me.
Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you as well, Andy.
Thanks, Ian.
And Jeremy Pelzer, politics reporter for Cleveland.com. Appreciate your time, Jeremy.
Happy Monday.
You too. And thanks to everybody else for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.